Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Wednesday marked the 50th anniversary of the police murder of two members of the Black Panther Party. In the cold, dark, early morning hours of December 4th, 1969, dozens of gunshots rang out on the west side of Chicago. Pulling the triggers were 14 police officers working in collaboration with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Their target was an apartment building that housed activists from the Black Panther Party for self-defense. When the smoke cleared, two men were dead, 22-year-old Mark Clark and 21-year-old Illinois Party Chair Fred Hampton. Several others were injured. The officers fired 99 shots. Authorities claimed the Black Panthers opened fire on the police who were there to serve a search warrant. But evidence later emerged that the Chicago police, the Cook County State's Attorney Office, and the FBI conspired to assassinate Fred Hampton, a revolutionary and powerful young speaker who formed a rainbow coalition of people to engage in a class struggle. Here is Fred Hampton explaining how the ruling class uses racism to exploit working people.
What makes them mad about it is that they have Black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American Puerto Rican people of poor people of all descent, they had them caught up in their movements based on racism when the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says. We don't think you fight fire with fire best. We think you fight fire with water best. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight it with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state attorneys like this and reactionary state attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reactions with all of us people to get together and have an international proletarian revolution.
Right on.
And that's saying all power to the people.
Right on.
That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbilly and I hate Indians. So we're fighting amongst each other. And you heard the testimony of pigs here. You got pigs of all colors, you know that. You got pigs that are white, you got pigs that are black, you even got pigs that are black and white. Propagating the same type of madness that this buffoon Henry had would be propagating if he were here himself. And why? Because they want to keep you to believing that I'm your enemy, and that everybody else that's black and that wears a lot of hair on his head and hair on his face, they want to keep you thinking that he's your enemy. Why? Because if ever you would disregard him and overlook him just for a minute and throw away that question of racism and started to deal with a little logic, then there would be no one else you could attack other than Hanrahan, other than Daley, and other than Tricky Dickie Nixon. If you make the right decision, then the oppressed people of the world will get complete satisfaction. I know you return a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
Fred Hampton was born on August 30th, 1948 in Summit, Illinois. He became a member of the NAACP when he was just 12, and no one was convicted of his murder. On today's Your Call, we will remember Fred Hampton and his activism, which lives on today. Today, we're joined by Emery Douglas, an amazing graphic artist who was the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. Emery Douglas's poster honoring Fred Hampton says, "You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution." Emery Douglas met with Fred Hampton in the Bay Area when he was starting up the Chicago chapter. Hi, Emery. Thank you for coming in.
I'm glad to be here.
Great to see you. Thank you. Jeffrey Haas represented the Hampton family along with Flint Taylor as co-founders of the People's Law Office. Jeffrey Haas recounts those harrowing days in his book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. It was just released as a second edition with an updated preface. And Jeffrey Haas joins us from KANW in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's great to have both of you. Emery, I want to start off with you. You and Jeffrey were at an event in San Francisco this weekend at the Howard Zinn Book Festival talking about the life of Fred Hampton. How are you reflecting as Fred and the Black Panthers are getting a lot of media coverage this past week?
Fred was a comrade who everybody appreciated, loved highly, deeply. And so the reflection is one that we carry with us and continue to be inspired by in what endeavors we are involved in dealing with social justice issues today.
What about you, Jeffrey? How are you reflecting?
Well, it was very heavy. I was in Chicago on December 4th, on the 50th anniversary. Went to the place where the actual shootout or shoot-in occurred, and then was with a group of Chicago Panthers that night, all of whom were reminiscing on what they remembered about Fred and what they remembered about December 4th. So in many ways, it was a very rich period. It was a very sad period. But interesting, none of the Panthers who survived in any way regretted ever having joined the Panthers. They all felt it was probably the most important experience in their life.
Mm. What else struck you about what you heard from the Panthers that night?
I think the fact that the idealism that they entered the party with, somewhat naivete, it was 1969, and I think many of us felt the revolution which was happening around the world in China and Cuba and Africa and South America was about to happen here, and the Panthers were going to be the vanguard of that, and the Panthers were bringing people together. And there was a tremendous spirit in Chicago, and Fred had a large role in increasing that spirit, in electrifying people who came and heard him speak.
In your book, in the new preface, you write, Fred's message is more prescient today than 10 years ago when the book was first published. The urgent need for revolutionary and systematic change has never been clearer. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I thought about that, and I have been speaking to audiences, and I think it's clearer now, perhaps, than 10 years ago when Obama was just elected, that we need radical revolutionary change, that the authoritarian government we have, unregulated capitalism, is really leading to the destruction of the planet, the species. And if we don't take some immediate action to change the power, to determine, let the people have the power, take it away from the fossil fuel companies and the unregulated business corporations and the 1%, there's not going to be a future for our children. So I think more and more people are realizing that, and the Panther demands, or socialist demands, for land, bread, housing, end of mass incarceration. Those things are clearer now, and perhaps more people are ready to join a movement which has those demands.
Mm. Emery, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. We're dealing with institutional racism and genocide, slow genocide in reality, that's what exists today. And the psychological impact of it is one that we have to be able to challenge, because it's pacifying a lot of folks to believe that in many ways that this is the greatest thing that ever happened. And so you have to deal with those mindsets, the mental shackling, bondage, what we're dealing with today.
Mm. Just before the show, Emery, we were talking about just all of the bodies that are on the streets mm-hmm. in the Bay Area. In fact, the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, just sent out an announcement about a triage center that's going to be started in a parking lot because so many people are now living in their cars.
Yes, you have more and more homeless, blocks and blocks of homeless, but at the same time, you got blocks and blocks of high rises going up.
Right.
And all this, so the contradiction is very clear.
Oh, it's so clear in this city. Mm-hmm. And then I was telling you yesterday, our guest said that when he was riding the bus to the station, it was mostly people of color, and four people with uniforms got on and cited them and kicked them off because mm-hmm. they didn't pay.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people going to work who possibly can't afford the bus bus trip.
Yeah. That's the institutional bigotry and bias that exists. Yeah.
And I was spending the night listening to Fred's speeches, and what he said back then could be said today.
Mm-hmm.
If you just cleared up some of the buzz, because the audio is kind of, quality's not. If you cleared it up and didn't tell anyone, they would think he gave that speech yesterday.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But Fred would say, what you going to do? What's your program?
Right.
How you going to confront it? How you going to deal with it?
Okay, so mm-hmm. let's talk about that first, Emery, because on this show, we deal with these issues day in and day out. And lately, we've been getting messages from listeners saying, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
So What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you start from where they are and get involved in some kind of way. Not necessarily look for this grand organization, because that doesn't exist at this point. But if there's something that they can do that's dealing with community transformation and changing thoughts and ideals and bringing people together, that's the process, a part of the process. And that's how they should begin to get involved.
Mm.
Yeah.
How did Fred tackle that issue, Jeffrey, about how to get involved and how to be effective?
Well, I think Fred started in high school demanding more black teachers and administrators. He was made the head of the NAACP, and he led a march for a swimming pool in Maywood for black kids because there was nothing available. And then he joined the Black Panther Party, and I think the party was about ending police brutality, was about decent housing, was about a Breakfast for Children program. What was needed? What were the community needs? But he also had a larger picture, like why should we be doing all these wars? And one of the demands of the Panthers was that black people not be drafted into wars to fight overseas. So I think many of these issues, and just recently that report that came out about Afghanistan, and finally some people are saying maybe we should check the defense budget. We need to do massive amount of we need a green climate, and we need the money to do that. And instead we're spending it on military and wasting it in wars. And we need money for our communities, for education and health care. These were things the Panthers wanted, but it seems like they're clearer today than they were then. And so I hope that I do believe that you pick it where you're at. In New Mexico, now our economy is based a lot on oil and gas drilling in the Permian Basin. So we have to stop that, even though our schools are being funded by that. We're digging a grave for the planet. So we have to find other sources other than petrol to build our economy. And the Green New Deal, it seems to me, is one of the ways we're doing it in New Mexico. We're also supporting indigenous-led movements because in New Mexico, the Navajo Nation has been a sacrifice zone for uranium and coal mining. And I was up at Standing Rock in the camp there that said, wait a minute, these are our lands. We have a duty to protect them and not just to send oil around the world, which is going to shorten the lifespan of humanity.
Mm. We just got an email, actually, from Carolyn, who said, this is such a prescient show. What can we do? And Emery, I feel like I sometimes hit my head against the wall because the guests say, call your congressperson, you know, join a group, take to the streets. Can you talk about the forces? That has really changed because the corporations are much more profitable. They're international. They run the government. I mean, that was in place back in the 60s, but now it's just, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, especially on the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a very ugly fight. So just like your experience is so interesting, given your past, and I mean, how do you think about these issues, about what it takes to create real change?
Well, it's education. That's mm-hmm. very important. And then it's implementing and practicing, but being supportive, very supportive of those things that are very constructive and about making the change transformation. This is an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm.
There's no secret gem that's going to stop it in just overnight. It's an ongoing process, and sometimes it can look like it's nothing can ever happen, but you have to continue, and the process is going to be ongoing. There may be points where it will be leaps and bounds and everything is exciting and what have you, but you still have to understand it's still about the institutional transformation and changing to overcome it, mm-hmm. to negate it. It's a process.
Jeffrey, how did Fred Hampton keep people engaged and motivated?
Well, I think there were two things. One is he had learned to speak in a way that was really electric, and people who heard him were moved by him. And it wasn't an accident. He actually had a speech defect, but he practiced this, learning the speeches of Dr. King and Malcolm X and going to church and hearing the cadence of black preachers. And so that he spoke with a beauty and a magnetism that affected everybody from welfare mothers to students to law students to lawyers. And so I think one of the things was what he, just about him, the energy around him, he sort of like gave off energy. And the other thing is, Fred didn't just ask people or wasn't a leader. If he said, let's go to the breakfast program, we got to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning making the food, serving the kids. Mm-hmm. Fred was there at 6 o'clock in the morning with everybody else. So some of those were, so people saw him as an example, not just of somebody who had ideas of what to do, but somebody who was doing it themselves. And he just gave off an energy that I think affected all of us. And that's why his death was such a blow, because he gave us strength to believe that we were not vulnerable anymore, that we could do the kind of things that he talked about. So I think a combination of the way he lived his life and the way he talked and just his overall long-term view affected everybody who came in contact with him.
To Emery's point, in your new preface, Jeffrey, you write, Fred was under no illusion that the capitalist U.S. government would meet the basic needs of the people. He and the Panthers were educating the people to make the dramatic change necessary. They set up the free breakfast program, the health clinic, as examples of what a system responsive to people's needs would provide and what the current government did not.
Yes, I think that it was sort of like by example. It was educating the people. It was saying the people have to make the kind of changes that we need, the fundamental changes that we need. And you talk about how people use where they're at. Emery has used his art to educate people, to motivate people. Some of us have tried to use our law to expose some of the injustices, including, as you said in your preface, what we now know about Fred's murder, that it was more than just the Chicago police. And Ed Hanrahan, and I think that speech you played is so good, because he's calling out Hanrahan, who was the heir apparent to Mayor Daley. And so Hanrahan was rising on a get tough on crime, particularly on black gangs, and he called the Panthers a gang. So they carried out the raid in Chicago, police attached to Hanrahan. But through 13 years of litigation, we learned that the FBI's COINTELPRO program is what led to the raid, that J. Edgar Hoover had set out a mandate to all FBI offices that had Panther chapters to destroy, disrupt, and neutralize the Panthers, this is their words, by any means necessary. And one of the mandates was to prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the masses. And they actually not only sent out that mandate, they had an FBI informant named William O'Neill give them a floor plan of the apartment where Fred would be sleeping, including the bedrooms and the actual bed where Fred Hampton and his fiancée, 8 months pregnant with their soon-to-be-born son, would be sleeping. So that when we actually traced the bullets, they went towards the bed where the raiders knew that Hampton would be sleeping. And I think the turning point in the case was when the Panthers and the Black Panthers led the black community, thousands of people, through that apartment, and they saw the directions of the bullets, that it was a shoot-in and not a shoot-out. Then I think finally the public turned against Hanrahan, and he never got elected to anything after that.
Wow. Let's talk about why Fred Hampton was such a threat to the state. I think the Rainbow Coalition is just such an important issue to talk about, because he was creating truces between gangs. And I remember watching a documentary about the Black Panthers, I don't know, about five years ago. And I was so struck by Fred and what he said when he brought different races together and, you know, basically explained how the ruling class uses racism to exploit working people. I mean, talk about this, Emery.
Yeah, well, that was the position of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. We had coalitions with everyone. We didn't, you know, and you had Panthers who come in, who painted with a broad brush, who began to understand that it was the system that they really were talking about. in the context and change their whole point of perspective or how they looked at transitioning and dealing with coalitions and alliances. So that was the policies of the Black Panther Party.
Can you talk about the conversations you all had about these issues?
Well, one of the famous, I remember Bobby Seale saying, we don't hate people because of the color of their skin. What we hate is unemployment. What we hate is inferior education. What we hate is indecent housing and the police brutality and the billy clubs against our head. So those were the things that we were educating and enlightening people about, the issues that we were confronted, the exploitation, all that, yeah.
And was there any debate around that? Because I think about the debate that's happening today around intersectionality, about identity politics.
Yeah, well, there was debate. There was debates. You know, you had those who were more nationalistic and as opposed to then dealing with alliances and coalitions. But that didn't bother us in relationship to the organization. That was our position. And that's how we seen the world. And so that's what we enlightened, informed, and began to grow and began to change those minds of those who had a very narrow perspective. Yeah.
Do you have memories of, let's say, you know, white working class people who for the first time came to your meetings?
Well, yeah. I mean, you had that. We had open political education classes. Yeah. Those who were the Free Youth Movement was a lot of working class whites who came and started to open up their houses and stuff and had rallies and wore the Free Huey buttons, came and bought papers, all those things, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What would you add, Jeffrey, about the power of this Rainbow Coalition?
Well, Fred saw that some of the issues, police brutality, inferior housing, bad education, were not just affecting the black community, but affected in Chicago uptown, which was people who had come from Appalachia were in uptown, and they had many of the similar conditions. And also in the Puerto Rican neighborhood, a group that started as a gang, the Young Lords, became political and was fighting gentrification in Lincoln Park. So and these were the groups that Fred formed a coalition with, the Young Lords, the Young Patriots, the Panthers. He also worked with SDS, which was in Chicago. So you did have these coalitions, and you had white working people saying the same thing about the police, about the education system, about inferior housing. So they came together around common issues. And I think Fred was a leader even in those communities. He also mentioned that I think Fred reached out to the two largest street gangs in Chicago, the Chicago Disciples and the Blackstone Rangers, and he was trying to build coalitions with them and getting them to work with the community rather than preying on the community. It was difficult. I think he had more success with the Disciples than he did immediately with the Rangers, but I think that's something that really concerned the police and the power structures. What if he actually united both the community and this Rainbow Coalition that was coming together? And it was a very heady time. Dr. King, of course, had come to Chicago. He did a march in 67 where he came out against the Vietnam War. The Panthers were against the Vietnam War. So you had a lot of white people involved in that, too. So you really had a coalition of forces that were demanding pretty radical, a revolutionary change that saw, as King said, the materialism and racism and imperialism that he spoke out against and the Panthers spoke out against was prevalent. And unfortunately, it's still prevalent. Mm.
Today on Your Call, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the police murder of two members of the Black Panther Party, 22-year-old Mark Clark and 21-year-old Fred Hampton. And today we're joined by Jeffrey Haas. Jeffrey represented the Hampton family, along with Flint Taylor, as co-founder of the People's Law Office. He recounts those harrowing days in his book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. Emery Douglas is a graphic artist who was the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party, and he met with Fred Hampton in the Bay Area when the Chicago chapter was forming. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. Just as sure. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss reports of sexual assault happening during Uber and Lyft rides. In an extensive report, Uber revealed that they received 5,981 reports of abuse of passengers and drivers between 2017 and 2018. And last week, 19 women filed a lawsuit against Lyft, saying they were sexually assaulted or raped by drivers. So I hope you can tune in for that tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the police murder of two members of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, 22-year-old Mark Clark and 21-year-old Fred Hampton. And if you'd like to join us, if you remember Fred Hampton, if you ever met him or heard him speak, if you've read about him over the years, if you were a member of the Black Panthers or you supported them, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Or if you have any questions for our guests, Emery Douglas or Jeffrey Haas, we'd love to hear from you. Emery Douglas is a graphic artist who was the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. He met with Fred in the Bay Area when the Chicago chapter of the party was forming. Jeffrey Haas is author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. Let's talk about some of the amazing social programs that you all started. A lot of people are familiar with the free lunch program, but maybe not too familiar with it. So, mm-hmm. Emery, how did that come about?
Well, the free breakfast for school kids in the morning, that came about because a lot of people don't realize in the beginning that Huey Newton and them had an advisory committee of middle-class blacks who they used to talk with. And Ruth Beckford, well-known dancer, was a part of that. Ron Dellum, when he was just a state representative, was a part of that. The very first mayor of Oakland, Lionel Wilson, was on that advisory committee. Different folks that they knew and they would connect and talk with. And I think it was Ruth Beckford who had suggested that maybe we could have the breakfast program, the first breakfast program where we had in church out of her pastor's church on 27th and West, which is in the hood in Oakland. And so that's how we began to have those, the breakfast, put them in, implementing the breakfast program mm-hmm. by getting suggestions from the community who thought it would be a good idea for those things. So it may have been a thought, but it was a thought that was being in the process of formalizing to phrase it into action. Mm. And yeah, and so from there we had it in many, we had it in churches, we had it in community houses, we had them in recreation centers, wherever the doors were open to having those breakfast programs, that's where we had them. The Panthers, along with the community, were the ones who got up at 2-3 in the morning to fix the breakfast. That was Chicago, wherever we had chapters and branches at that time, and served the food itself to the kids mm-hmm. when they came in mm-hmm. in the morning. And you have kids, folks today who say that was their only meal. Wow. They remember that breakfast program, and they were Panther was saying that he's a bus driver. And he heard these two guys arguing about the Panthers and another organization, which I don't want to mention. And he heard a guy say, "Well, the Panthers were doing this because I went to their breakfast program." Mm. So you hear a lot of that. People hear that who went to that program right. and served it. That was sometimes their only meal that they got.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeffrey, what would you add on the breakfast program? The other powerful thing that it did was it showed that the state was failing because so many people were so hungry.
Yes, the breakfast program was very popular in Chicago. They started with one at the Better Boys Club. They started one program. Then there were several programs throughout the city. The Panthers raised the money for the food. They got contributions. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, Hoover talked about the breakfast program and how effective it was, because with the breakfast also went political education. Mm-hmm. They were talking to the families, the mothers and the dads, about why they have a free breakfast program, and isn't that something the state should provide? I think Fred Hampton said, "Well, our people may not all understand socialism, but they understand the free breakfast program, and that's what mm-hmm. they want, mm-hmm. and that's what they should be getting." So it was very, the combination of providing the breakfast and educating the community about where the state had fallen down and why mm-hmm. should kids go to school hungry was really a very powerful message. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, when the twice the Chicago police and once the FBI raided and attacked the Panther office in Chicago, and actually they came in and urinated on the breakfast, on the cereal that had been raised mm-hmm. for the breakfast program, that they hated that because that allowed the Panthers really to do tremendous amount of outreach in the community.
Mm. Emery?
Yes, it was like Jeff said, it was about educating, enlightening, informing, pointing out the contradictions by the very effect of what we're doing. Then you had the communities and begin to demand these programs. That was why you had the free lunch programs implemented in the schools, was because of the free breakfast for school children program.
Hmm. Yeah. What about...
And it was called, J. L. Hill called it the free breakfast program as the number one threat to the internal security of the United States.
Wow. Jeffrey, what about medical care?
Well, that was something else that the Panthers did. They opened a medical clinic in Chicago, and they got volunteers from the community, but they also got liberal doctors to come and donate their time. And all of a sudden, there was a focus on sickle cell that the state had not provided, on dealing with it, on educating people about it. And a lot of services were provided at these free medical clinics in Chicago. And they were very effective. And once again, why do we have to go and pay for medical care? Why isn't this something that's a right that we have? So the medical clinic, and was interesting because at least two of the Panthers 50 years later had gone into some form of medicine, nursing, or had become doctors. And they said the experience of being in the medical clinic and what they learned there had affected the rest of their lives and their careers.
What would you like to add on the medical program?
Pardon me?
What would you like to add about
I would say that we had many volunteer doctors and nurses, mm-hmm. And that was a part of the coalition politics as well. Mm-hmm. Doctors who came in of all colors who served and contributed to the program itself. And was about, we were talking about preventative health care.
Right.
Then, you know, so we were giving tests to prevent, hopefully in advance, or let people know what some of the diagnosis of some of the things that we could offer in that context. And we did have mobile vans in some areas in the country who went around into the neighborhoods and did testing and all those things as well. We had volunteers students who were going to medical school who would come in and contribute also to the service itself.
And as you said, Emery, the government said that the breakfast program was a huge threat. Jeffrey, when you did your 13 years of litigation, what else stood out for you in terms of just learning about how the government saw the Black Panthers?
Well, I think Hoover has stated specifically the Panthers were the greatest threat to the internal security of the U.S. But the fact that they had this program and that they were willing to use any method to carry it out. One of the things we learned and got in discovery was an actual hit letter that was sent to Jeff Fort, the leader of the Blackstone Rangers. And it was, of course, it wasn't sent on FBI stationery. It was on a blank page hand scribble, and it said, "Dear Brother Jeff, I'm a Black brother. I've been hanging out with the Panthers. I think you ought to know they got a hit out on you. I know what I'd do if I was you. Signed, a Black brother." So they were actually mm-hmm. seeking that the Blackstone Rangers would retaliate against the Panthers and Fred Hampton. This was how far they were willing to go in that program. So I think how far they went. The other thing was how much effort they made to cover up what happened. The FBI internally took credit for the raid. They gave their informant, who provided the floor plan, a $300 bonus and said his information that led to the success of the raid was not available from any other source. But externally, they were denying any role. A federal grand jury came and investigated the raid and never mentioned the FBI role or the FBI floor plan or the FBI giving that floor plan to the raiders. So there was so much cover-up of what happened And of course, Hanrahan, immediately after the raid, he and the raiders went on TV. They showed guns found in the Panther apartment and said that they had been opened fired upon. They didn't know it was a Panther crib, although they went there with handguns, shotguns, a carbine, and a machine gun, and then opened fire. So they covered up the fact that it was actually 97 shots coming in. The only outgoing shot was from Mark Clark's weapon after he had been fatally shot in the heart because it went up into the ceiling. So both the act, how nefarious it was, and also the efforts made to cover it up by both the police in Chicago and the federal government were appalling. And I think one of the messages we came away with was the government kills.
Wow. Well, and so many of our listeners will remember this time. You had Dr. Martin Luther King killed April 4th, 1968. Malcolm X killed February 21st, 1965. Nixon was president. The Vietnam War was escalating. Emory, I mean, when you look back at that time, what do you remember about just what people were talking about? And there was so much tension happening.
Well, we were young people, so yeah. So we were kind of were fearless in many ways, and so we tried to step up to the challenge and confront those things in a way that would be provocative and enlightening, and to inform people about what all those things that were taking place, because we were in solidarity with those who opposed to the war in Vietnam. Matter of fact, we had Panthers who went to Vietnam. We had Panthers who were solidarity committees in relationship with the Vietnamese when they had the conference in Canada. We had Panthers who went there and what have you. And so we were opposed to the war, and we were part of the anti-war movement protests that took place across the country, all those things, yes.
Mm. What about your activism? Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from growing up. Mm-hmm. Life. Mm-hmm. Life is a journey itself, and I tried to talk to that as a kid, you know, growing up coming to San Francisco when I was 7 years old, and going to the South with my auntie the first time in about 1954. And we get on the bus, going to Tulsa, Oklahoma. We had to get off the bus. It's in Oklahoma City. She grabs my hand when we go into the bus station to change the bus. And she says, now, when we go in here, we have to sit in there. We can't sit out there. And we can't eat in here. And you have to use this bathroom in here. You can't use that one out there. And it was a small room. And it was said, for colors only. And on the bathroom, it said, for colors only. So I became aware through that, and looking at the news on TV and seeing what was taking place with the civil rights movement. Maybe when we had television, had two or three stations, but then you could see every now and then what was going on, the civil rights movements and the lynching that took place, and the hoses and the tanks. You used to see those things as a kid. And then you flash on the international news every now and then. You've seen the same thing in South Africa during that time as well. All those things. When Fannie Lou Hamer, I remember Fannie Lou Hamer, when the delegation went to the Democratic Convention the first time, all black. And I'm excited and looking at it. Don't know what it's about, but because it's black people, I'm seeing what's going on. And they denied. And so I recall and see it again when they went back and they were accepted at the as a delegation from Mississippi. Yeah, so there's things like that in life's journey, that in the rebellions and the riots and the took place and the police murders that were always being justified. Those all that. Yeah, and then when you going to college, and the still defining you as Negro and the black consciousness coming where people we want to define themselves as African-American, those debates took place and changed the name of the students' associations from the Negro Students' Associations to the Black Students' Association was a big thing, and you almost called a communist or this because of that thing there. So those things, conscious raising, yeah.
How did you become the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party?
Well, eventually, that was a process when we began to develop and grow. And you had people coming in who had these different skills and needed areas of responsibility to work in. So it was kind of was kind of like reflection of looking at some of the revolutionary movements who had different ministries, and socialist governments had to. So it was formed like structured like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. But that's what it came. The Ministry of Information. You had the Ministry of Culture, Health Ministry, all the school education, so that when people had those skills, they could be channeled into those different ministries to do work and stuff. Yeah.
That is Emery Douglas, an incredible graphic artist who is the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party, and his poster honoring Fred Hampton says, "You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution." Jeffrey Haas represented the Hampton family along with Flint Taylor as co-founders of the People's Law Office. Jeffrey Haas is the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. It's just been released as a second edition with an updated preface. And today we are marking the 50th anniversary of the police murder of 21-year-old Illinois Party Chair Fred Hampton. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions, comments, any memories you'd like to share, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for this program. Just a comment and then maybe a question. I'm still amazed when you look back over the last, I don't know how many years, at all the assassinations that took place in the 60s and 70s of George Jackson, Fred Hampton, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and the two Kennedys. The history of assassinations in this country has dealt a political havoc, it seems to me. But the real question I wanted to ask you was, what can you comment on what's happened in Chicago since Hampton's assassination with regard to any of his vision being realized in Chicago?
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Jeff, do you want to take that first?
All right. Well, I think there were two legacies that I traced to the murder of Fred. On the one hand, the black community lost a very powerful, youthful leader. I think gangs and drugs on the West Side became more prevalent because there wasn't an alternative. On the other hand, the coming together of the black community and the liberal white community. The black community had been somewhat divided on the Panthers, but not about the murder of a young leader in his bed at 4:30 in the morning. They formed a coalition, the community and liberal whites, and it was that coalition that eventually elected Harold Washington mayor. So I think in many ways that was one of the legacies. On the other, in terms of the police, I was involved again with Flint in exposing that there was a police torturer in Chicago torturing black suspects to get confessions out of them that was allowed to go on through years with 100 suspects, both through a community effort. The victims' families actually mounted a campaign to expose, get Bird fired, and actually get reparations for the community, not only for the victims, but for the victims' families, and that the Bird story of torture in Chicago and the fact that it was accepted at the highest levels by the mayor is now being taught in the schools, and there's a memorial being built. And again, also more recently in Chicago, when Laquan McDonald was killed, the community rose up, various community organizations and organizers refused to stop until the killer was actually, the policeman was charged with murder, was convicted of second-degree murder. The state's attorney, the police chief, and even Ron Emanuel, the mayor, lost his job because of the community efforts to expose this blatant example of police brutality. Of course, the video came out later that showed Laquan McDonald was shot 16 times, was not a threat to the officer who was shooting him, and he continued to be shot as he was lying on the ground. On the other hand, the fact that the police union, the police chief and everything originally rallied around the policeman, verified his story of self-defense. So that hasn't changed much. I think the police union still, we used to say, they never saw a case of police brutality they didn't like or support. So I think some things have changed in Chicago, and I think the community is more involved, more activated around police issues. And of course, this was one of the key issues of the Panther Party, an end to police brutality. They started following the police out in Oakland. And the community control of police was a major issue. So in some ways, I think there's been more enlightenment. On the other hand, I can't say that the psychology of the police department or of cities and administration's support of them has changed. And I'm really interested to see what Chesa Boudin, who was just elected state's attorney in San Francisco, can do to change the criminal justice system and make it a fair justice system and actually prosecute white-collar crime.
Mm. Right, and for people who live outside the area, Chesa Boudin was elected as district attorney of San Francisco. He's a Democratic socialist. He's got an incredible story as the children of members of the Weather Underground. What about you, Emery? What would you like to add about what has and hasn't changed in Chicago? What stands out?
Well, I think there's a whole youth movement now, and I think that there is still the legacy of Fred and the Panthers still continues on, and when you see through those youngsters and others who begin to demand for quality of life issues. Mm-hmm. And transforming.
And I wonder what you think when you were saying that when we got the TVs and there were three channels. Mm-hmm. Now, for people who either didn't believe.
And they most were black and white. They weren't color.
That's right, black and white. I just think about the fact that we have this almost this weapon now, this cell phone, right? Mm-hmm. Where we can videotape things immediately.
Yes.
And now the things that you have all been talking about for decades are out there for everybody to see. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on all these videos of police brutality that we're seeing?
Well, on the one hand, it's showing the brutality in the institutional relationship to what you could say legalized murder, and knowing nothing that's not going to happen about it, and at the same time, with the electronic media. People all over, you can see what's happening all over the world, that you can see how it's coming from centralized governments, training those in different countries to repress the people in the same way, because you see it happening in real time now through the electronic media. So you have a whole universal kind of solidarity resistance and coming together in regards to these concerns, because you have all over the country. What you have is you have prison, private type of prisons. You know, I was in Australia 5 or 6 years ago, and I asked them, do you have any private type prisons in here? And they say, yeah, Bechtel was the same thing when I was in New Zealand. You have the privatization of prisons. That's, you know, the indigenous folks are the ones who are highest rate of incarceration, mm-hmm. Lack of education, all those employment. The same thing. It's universal now. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What would you add on that, Jeffrey?
Well, I do think that on the one hand, there is a very strong youth movement. A lot of people realize if we don't bring about change, if we don't take the power away from the 1%, things are just continue to get worse, and we see it now as the income is getting less and less equal in this country, around the world. We see authoritarian regimes take over. So the cover of democracy has sort of been removed. Mm-hmm. The U.S. doesn't claim to be a supporter of democracy. As we know, Trump's closest mm-hmm. friends are who's his favorite dictator of the week. Whether it's Netanyahu or the Crown Prince or Bolsonaro, mm-hmm. they're all similar in the way that they carry out, in some form, white supremacy, authoritarianism, attacks on indigenous people. And these are things that we see. Also up at Standing Rock and in Ferguson, we also saw more sophisticated methods of repression, new weaponry, new forms of tear gas. We also saw private security firms like Tiger Swan that started in Iraq now aiding these oil companies in their pipelines. We see the penalties for people who protest these pipelines or any part of them. Penalties have gone up tenfold. ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council, has made increasing penalties for people who protest pipelines. That made that a priority. And so they also, which are well-funded by the most reactionary businesses, do a lot of legislation, including getting states to pass these bills that make that incarcerate more and more people around immigration things, and then private prisons are taking over the incarceration of supposedly illegal or undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. So we see these things coming together.
Mm. Final thoughts from you, Emery. I think that the Rainbow Coalition is so incredibly crucial today. What are your thoughts about continuing that idea behind the Rainbow Coalition?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Absolutely. That's the only way you're going to transform, negate what exists. Mm. It can't do it in isolation. That's very limited and very narrow perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
And what are your thoughts just in terms of thinking about the Rainbow Coalition? We got an email from Mike who says, what do you think of what's happening today compared to 50 years ago?
Well, it's a whole other dynamics 50 years ago. You know, you had to dismantle all the social programs 50 years ago in relation to that, that helped those who needed it, you know, and then you got the youngsters who come up, you have four or five generations of babies having babies, you got, you know, the substance abuse who came into the neighborhoods and beyond boundaries of neighborhoods and what have you. You have those dynamics. Then you have young people who become their whole thing was the hip hop and making $1 million on hip hop out of their trunks before it even became mainstream. And then you got these youngsters today who follow these youngsters who weren't making millions of dollars, and now the personalities of young, the ones that these youngsters follow today are those hip hop artists who they glorify in sports as well as in the entertainment world, and then brought that together. And so you got all those dynamics that you're dealing with. Of course, you got some in there who are doing some very constructive and relative things, but it's the whole scheme at the same time is to contain it and control it and to make it exploitation profitable for those billionaires already.
That is Emery Douglas, an amazing graphic artist who was the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. Emery met with Fred Hampton in the Bay Area when the Chicago chapter was forming. Jeffrey Haas represented the Hampton family as co-founder of the People's Law Office. He's the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. Emery and Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose. And I don't know if it was serendipitous, but you played Fred's favorite song, We'll Be Together.
Yes,
brief music
by Diana Ross.
Did you know that?
I did that on purpose because I heard that he played that song during his speeches. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.